You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Where the sidewalk ends and the road begins. 7:35 here on a Monday morning. We continue. And the story that, if you're a Marine, I don't know that you can help but follow, has been in the news now for, I don't know, probably over a month. And somebody who is at the heart of the story joins us, and Matt Morgan joins us this morning. Matt, first of all, good morning. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. First of all, Matt, we need to find out about you. So born and raised where?
Born and raised in central Illinois. Small town just south of Champaign, Urbana, Illinois.
All right.
Went on to went to college near there at the University of Illinois on an ROTC scholarship.
Oh, so how did that get on your radar at a young age?
You know, I had a Marine show up at my school one day. He was actually had been one of the Marine security guards at the embassy in Tehran.
Yikes.
And so he had been a hostage. You know, about 5 days after he arrived in Tehran, the embassy fell. So he'd been a hostage, and he came back and talked to our, I think it was third grade class, about his experience. Of course, I remember him being in his dress blues. And then a couple years later, when the Beirut barracks were bombed, I think it was probably one of the first moments when I really recognized, I kind of put those things together. And from that point on, it was all I ever wanted to do was be a Marine.
Wow. That's it. So nobody in your family, no other influence other than, recruiter coming to speak. And that's interesting.
That was it. And it wasn't until I actually was commissioned that one of my uncles came to me and told me the story. He had been an Army machine gunner on the east side of Chosin. The Marines had actually evacuated him. But I never knew any of that until after I was commissioned. So that was probably the closest familial connection.
On the east side of the Chosin, there were not too many Army guys that got out of that thing. So, wow.
No, they were overrun. He was wounded. He actually crawled about two miles across the reservoir to get to the Marine lines.
Wow. That's another show in and of itself. So you go to University of Illinois, the big campus, or where did you go?
Yeah, big campus, Champaign, Urbana.
Nice.
ROTC guy there, and then was commissioned in 93.
So you commissioned in 93 as an infantry officer, yes?
That's right.
All right, and where do you head?
Once I finished IOC, I went out to SoCal. I was with 1st LAR. Did a 15th MU deployment there and came back and was having the time of my life. I was a company XO, you know, going to the range every other day, just probably the best job you can have in the Marine Corps. And then the monitor calls and says, hey, it's time for orders. It's a long story, but I'll make it quick. I effectively asked him if there was a possibility that I could stay there at Camp Pendleton, in a B billet somewhere, and, mentioned public affairs. You know, we did these dog and pony shows with the LAVs for public affairs. I thought that'd be a good way to stick around Camp Pendleton and just, spend more time on Liberty. So he told me if I wanted to go, to public affairs to put it in AA form. And I had no idea what that was. So I went to my adjutant, who at the time, infantry battalions didn't have actual 0180 school-trained adjutants. It was just some grunt who got stuck being the battalion adjutant. And
right.
So I asked him for an AA form, and he pulled one out of his drawer. And I said, what do I do? How do I fill it out? He said, I don't know. Go ask the warrant officer. And so I filled it out with the perso and submitted it, and ended up with orders to public affairs school. What I didn't recognize until I graduated from public affairs school was that my primary MOS had been changed. So my time as an infantry officer came to an end. Yeah. So all the things that lieutenants do not know about Marine Corps manpower.
Right. So you moved to public affairs. But I mean, that seems to work out well. So from there, you talk to us about some of the interesting things. So you get to all over the world essentially as a public affairs guy, and what don't we know? And then you wind up in Los Angeles with our office. It coordinates with motion pictures, and so it all turns out well. Talk to us about your career as a public affairs officer. Obviously, a good one.
Well, you know, I always tell people that I've been getting out of the Marine Corps since I was a lieutenant, but they just kept offering me what I thought were jobs I couldn't turn down. And shortly after becoming a PAO, they decided that they needed a Marine with some infantry experience, with some USOC experience at the Public Affairs Office in Los Angeles. And so I went there, spent several years, got to advise on a few films, you know, for better or worse, worked on John Woo film Wind Talkers, worked on The Sum of All Fears, and obviously really had a great time doing that. Was in that job actually on 9/11. And so shortly thereafter, wow, I was offered a position with the 4th Marine Expeditionary Brigade, which at the time was being stood up as some kind of new anti-terrorism capability, mm-hmm, which sounded pretty sexy. So I took the orders to go there, and then never deployed with the 4th MEF. Went to OIF-1 with 1 MEF as an attachment, and had a great opportunity to lead a team of combat camera Marines and sailors to shoot the first ever high-definition footage in combat. And after that, one thing after another, went to the Horn of Africa, ended up at Command and Staff College. You know, before you know it, you're a field grade officer with more than 10 years in. Mm-hmm. So, and with the, you know, with the opportunities being presented to deploy, I stayed at it right up until, the 20 year mark, and decided at that point that we were going to step away from the Corps. And, I had 2 young boys and I wanted to bring them somewhere where I could raise them. And that led us ultimately to Northern Michigan.
Why Northern Michigan if you're an Illinois guy? How did that get on your radar?
Well, I didn't have a huge desire to return back to Illinois. But my wife was born and raised here in Northern Michigan. She's also a Marine. We met in Hawaii back in 2000 when I was working on the film Wind Talkers. But we were married up here, and I'd never really spent any time up there, and I fell in love with it. It's just a beautiful place, and we live in a little summer resort town called Traverse City.
My guest this morning on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio is Lieutenant Colonel Matt Morgan, and he's been a principal in the development and the story that surrounds the Unknown Flag Raiser, which is going to premiere this Sunday on the Smithsonian Channel. And if you know anything about the Smithsonian Channel, you have some idea about the quality of work that they produce on a consistent basis. It's going to premiere at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time, and something that if you're a Marine and have been following this story, which I think a lot of Marines have, you'll certainly be tuned in on Sunday night. So he's been gracious enough to join us. We're learning about him. I always ask, Matt, what about influences in your life in terms of leadership? Who impacted you as a leader and as you grew up in the Marine Corps?
Well, the first was probably my battalion commander. My first BLT commander was a guy named Kevin Brickhouse. And what really stuck with me is he promoted me to first lieutenant, which isn't like the most seminal promotion, for an officer in the Marine Corps, I don't think. Maybe it's because their first promotion, you know, they always say the difference between a first lieutenant and a corporal is Lance Corporal's been promoted twice. I was going to pin on this bar. Wasn't a big deal. We decided we were going to do it at the officers club on a Thursday night, and pretty much all of the battalion officers were hanging out there. And he called the officers together outside and said, before I do this, I want you all to listen to what the President of the United States has to say about Matthew Morgan. To all who shall see these presents, greetings. Know thee that you're reposing special trust and confidence. And he does the whole thing from memory. You know, so he has the commission memorized. And it made
impressive.
A tremendous impact. Yeah, it really kind of takes the moment, makes you think about what's happening. And then he finishes up and turns and says, face me, raise your right hand. I state your name. And then he does the entire oath of office from memory. And that made a tremendous impact on me to the point that any time for the rest of my career that I did a reenlistment or a promotion, I memorized either the oath of enlistment or the oath of office. Because I felt that it was so important and it made such a big impact on me. And it really does change the way, the experience for the individual Marine, whether he's reenlisting or being promoted.
Because, as the person being promoted, you're thinking of, I'm cutting into everybody's Thursday night and the CO is going to make everybody come down here. It's just a promotion from second lieutenant to first lieutenant. And all of a sudden it gets transformed into an inspiring event where you essentially rededicate yourself to what you originally signed up for and raised your hand to. And very, very cool, Matt. Very, very cool. Now, was he the MU commander or your battalion commander?
He was my BLT commander.
Okay.
He's battalion commander at 1-1, and it just made a tremendous impression on me. He always – and the thing he told his Marines, when he turned over command, the last thing he told his Marines was that if you remember one thing in life is to always keep a warming lair and an extra chow in your butt back. And that stuck with me too.
I'll tell you what, sage words from a guy who's obviously spent some cold, hungry nights on the planet.
Absolutely. It was funny because he was a Copenhagen man, and he was always bumming dips for Marines. And so when he came out for his final formation, he had a tin of Copenhagen in basically every pocket in his utilities. And he just started tossing them into the formation and telling the guys that if you never paid them back, then this is for that.
Well, I mean, the age old line is, hey, I'm quitting. Can I bum a dip? That's why I don't have it. That's why I don't have any. Again, Matt Morgan, our guest here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Matt, talk about, I'm curious about you, into Iraq during the march up. You guys did some filming that had never been done in the Marine Corps before. What did you do? And then I've got an email question for you too.
We had two teams. One was a team that went with Delta Company First Tanks through the breach, and for the march up. And then the second team that I was with, we started on the USS Constellation, and were shooting the first sorties to fly into Iraq on D-Day. From there, we bounced up to the USS Ponce, covered some of the Naval Special Warfare units operating off of that, and then on into Umm Qasr and up through to Basra. And not long after that, I ended up having to scoot around and collect all of the videotape, because at the time we were still shooting tape from all of our teams, and then take that back to Los Angeles to start cutting it.
Here's the email question. Mac, I've heard a lot about what the L.A. office of the Marine Corps' public affair arm does. I'd be curious to know from the lieutenant colonel what exactly they do. So, Matt, we've heard a lot of different things about that. It sounds like it's a pretty cool job. What exactly does the L.A. office that the Marine Corps keeps that kind of does the liaison with the film business? What exactly do you guys do?
Well, the office's primary mission was to work with the television and motion picture industry on realistic and accurate depiction of U.S. Marines. But in fact, just this spring, the Marine Corps is closing that office. I think it's regrettable, but it's just something that they were forced to do as a consequence of downsizing. The public affairs community is experiencing some real challenges in regards to manpower. And so they just did not have enough field grade officers, specifically lieutenant colonels, to keep that office open.
Wow. So the mission was it to influence editorial comment in terms of hey, you know, we don't care for this? Or was it simply to make sure that what they depicted was accurate? What were you influencing? Well, did you do both?
Sure, we were influencing. I mean, the program itself is guided by a DOD instruction. So the Marine Corps on its own cannot make specific decisions. They have to make recommendations to the Office of the Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
And when they once they gain the approval of the Secretary of Defense, then the Marine Corps is free to provide some kind of in kind. And that's what most filmmakers are looking for, is they want a location or they want equipment. And then, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, we could offer a great deal. You know, for the sum of all fears, we were able to offer three CH-53s for shooting a sequence of where the president is rescued after a nuclear blast. And in so doing, we review the script and we ensure that the content is not just accurate, but that the content is consistent with the way we want to see Marines portrayed on the big screen. And sometimes that requires a negotiation process, and it doesn't always go smoothly. But it definitely is. We're looking for some kind of favorable representation. It doesn't always mean you have to everything. You know, rainbows and unicorns. One example is we worked on the film Rules of Engagement with Sam Jackson and Tommy Lee Jones. And, you know, the entire inciting incident in that film involves Sam Jackson's character executing an NVA prisoner. So there was a lot of heartburn about the fact that that's how the film was set up. But what we did is to ensure that in the end, the individual Marine has to face the consequences of his decision. So, like I said, it's not always about making sure we look good. It's about making sure that our core values are represented in the content.
All right. Matt Morgan, our guest, Lieutenant Colonel, Infantry and Public Affairs Officer in the United States Marine Corps. If you have a question or comment, you can send a text, 714-661-8107. You can send an email to live.allmarineradio@gmail.com. Or you can give us a phone call here at 714-884-4294. Matt, let's set up. We got about 8 minutes, and we're going to take about a three-minute break, and then we'll come back. But set up for me, if you will, what you're doing out of the office in Los Angeles when you first hear, I'll get this out, this idea that maybe there was a mistake in the iconic Joe Rosen, the identification of the Marines and sailor in the Rosenthal photo. What were you doing? How did this come to you? Set that up for us.
Well, it's 2005. I had actually moved on, and I was now a student at Command and Staff College in Quantico. But I had maintained a close friendship with a retired sergeant major named James Deaver. Deaver had worked with me as an advisor on Windtalkers, and he stayed in the motion picture industry and was working for Clint Eastwood on Flags of Our Fathers. And so he called me one day and said, hey, I got something interesting here. I don't think John Bradley is in this picture. And that's kind of where it started from. And I said, well, what do you mean he's not in the picture? He's like, well, look at this. He's this number two man from the right, and this guy's wearing a cartridge belt. He's got on wire cutters. He looks like a left. He doesn't look like a corpsman. And I looked at the photos, and I immediately, came to the same conclusion. I think anybody that's, you know, even remotely familiar with World War II equipment and infantry in general is going to look at that and say, you're right, that doesn't at all make sense that would be a corpsman. So from there on out, I decided to look into whatever I could find on the subject to figure out how the mistake might have been made and what the real answer was.
Now, what led him to that? Was it simply looking at Rosenthal's iconic image, or did he? Because you and I were talking about this the other day, because some of the images I had never seen before, and I'm an Iwo Jima guy. I've got, I don't know, maybe a couple thousand images, and when I see one I don't have, I grab it and I throw it in this PowerPoint that I have. What made him think that? Was it simply looking at the equipment in the iconic photograph, or did he see other photographs?
Well, the first guy to call his attention to it was the prop master, who approached him and said, "Hey, I got an issue here because you guys have given us these photos, and we have these photos of John Bradley, the first flag raiser. And that all makes sense. He's wearing a pistol belt. He has his 45. He's got these Unit 3, the two bags that he's carrying that constitute what today we consider a full Unit 1 for a corpsman. You know, all of that makes sense. But the problem is that when I now we're supposed to be putting him in this other scene where he's raising the flag, and he's supposed to be this guy, but he's got different equipment on. You know, so from a prop master's perspective, he's concerned about continuity.
Right.
You know, that thing in movies where people are wearing the same thing or holding the same thing or dressed the same way. And so it was first him that called his attention to it. And so the sergeant major looked at it and said, "Wow, you know, you're right. I've never thought about that. I never even questioned it. You know, we've always been told these are the guys that are in the image, and that's what we did." And the sergeant major was actually kind of stunned with that. And another subject was, he had been at one point as a sergeant, he had been at 8th and I. And he's like, "You know, I marched by that monument every day all summer for 3 years. And I never thought to question anything on it. But when they were making the film, they were getting ready to do the flag raising scene, and Barry Pepper, who played Spank in the film, took off his helmet. And the sergeant major went over and said, "What are you doing? Get your helmet back on." And he said, no, look, we looked at this footage here, and Mike Strank actually takes his helmet off just before that flag goes up, and he's not wearing it when it does. So, and the sergeant major's like, "Hell, you know what? You're right." So it took an actor who had been studying the mechanics of the film to call his attention to that detail.
You know,
so
that's,
at that point, he's like,
"No, that's you know, it's interesting because we as Marines have this lens that we look at that." And I'll tell you what, if I was doing a reenactment over the 4th of July, everybody would have their damn helmet on, that's for sure. I mean, that's the lens that we see this through. And like you said, the Sergeant Major said, "I marched past that thing forever and never thought, because they had been so identified." And but then here's these guys whose technical business it is to get this stuff right, and they're calling these nuanced, you know, the subtleties of the migration from this picture to that picture, and saying, "Hey, look, this doesn't make sense to me, but for 70 years, that's the way we saw it." I just find that so interesting. And then all the other questions that it brings up. So this comes to you in 2005, yes?
That's right.
And so what did you guys think?
Well, you know, what I did is I looked at the history behind it. I grabbed a hold of everything that I could get my hands on at History Division there. And what I found out was, first and foremost, that the raisers had been identified differently on about 5 different occasions over the first 2 or 3 months after the flag raising. I have the message traffic or the message logbook from the regimental headquarters on Iwo Jima when they wrote down the names of the individuals who had been identified. And these guys weren't identified until a full month after the flag raising had taken place. So there's already some question, because at this point, 3 of them are already dead. One of them, John Bradley, is wounded. And only 2 of them remain on the island, and that is Ira Hayes and Rainey Gagnon. So, you know, you look at that and you realize, okay, so these only 5 guys are initially identified, as the story goes, because Ira Hayes told Gagnon that he'd kill him if he told anybody he was in the picture. You know, Gagnon identifies 5 guys, himself among them, as well as James Bradley. But what's notable is that when you look at the logbook and it lists the names, next to John Bradley's name, it says in parentheses, "in background." So Rainey Gagnon initially identified Bradley as the man on the far side whose only a portion of his helmet was showing.
All right.
So I started to see, you know, that they had been misidentified. And so I kind of reached an early conclusion that Bradley was probably in the photo. He was just the guy on the back, and they'd gotten them mixed up.
The logbook. Wow. All right, Matt, we're going to take a quick break. You can hold on, right?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Matt Morgan, our guest. He a lieutenant colonel, infantry in public affairs, and a principal in what will be the Smithsonian Channel's upcoming special, The Unknown Flag Raiser. It premieres this Sunday night at July 3rd at 9 p.m. Eastern. That would be 6 p.m. for us here on the West Coast. We'll continue an interesting discussion with him, and it gets more interesting, trust me, right after this on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
America, let me tell you about Sergeant Greg Anderson. Served two tours in Afghanistan, Bronze Star and Purple Heart recipient, and unemployed. The unemployment rate among transitioning service members is unacceptably high, much higher than the general population. Veterans are a proven commodity. They're mature, reliable, and hardworking. They deserve a chance to get back to work after serving their country. Do you really want to honor a veteran? Hire one. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
Military life is rewarding, but it isn't always easy.
Managing the stress can affect even the strongest warrior.
But I can. I will stay mission ready.
I can. I will
keep my mind and body fit.
Talk to my chaplain.
Seek care early.
Strive for progress, not perfection.
I got this.
I got this.
Take the first step.
There's no better time than now.
Reaching out is a sign of strength. Visit realwarriors.net or call 800-874-2273.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We needed big music for this segment because it's huge if you're a Marine. And Lieutenant Colonel Matt Morgan continues with us. Matt, first of all, again, thank you for joining us this morning and coming on and talking about your experiences here in the rectifying what has been an error for 70 years, over 70 years, relative to the identification of the Marines and sailor in Joe Rosenthal's iconic photograph. I've got a question for you. Mac, I followed this story in the news, and I was as astounded as anybody that kind of mistake could have been made and still being made after all these years. I read the story in the Omaha World Herald. Did Mike have any contact with the two historians or were they progressing on a separate track? So, Mike, your relationship between, what is it? Is it Crowley. Foley is the Irish guy?
Yeah. Well, you know, their theory, I'll call it, is what energized our entire project. So as we were talking earlier that Sergeant Major Deaver had made this recognition back in 2005 when they were making the film, you know, ironically based on a book written by John Bradley's son. And so we looked at it, but I couldn't come to any real, you know, breakthrough. I realized that I agreed with Deaver that this was most likely not Bradley, but we needed to figure out who it was. And I was kind of I hit a dead end. I didn't have any conclusive thought as to who it might be. I just thought they were mixed up. And so I basically, at that point, dropped it. But it always kind of remains in the back of your mind. And then in 2013, shortly after I retired, Sergeant Major Deaver called me and said, hey, listen, I'm going to be working with Clint Eastwood again on this new film, American Sniper. And I need somebody with some Iraq experience, some more recent experience. Would you be willing to come out and help us on this? And so I agreed to do that. And it was interesting because it effectively was reuniting the entire crew from Flags of Our Fathers, at least, you know, certain key individuals, including the prop master, Mike Sexton, who had worked on Flags of Our Fathers, was also the prop master the sniper. And we began talking about this notion again of John Bradley not being there and the fact that this would make a really interesting documentary if we could only answer one question, and that is, if it's not John Bradley, then who is it? And so that fall, surprisingly enough, the Omaha World Herald published this piece with this really coherent theory that this amateur historian had put together. And as soon as we read, we called him, put him in a hold agreement, basically make him a partner in producing the film, and we moved out from there.
Now, your relationship to the film is what?
I'm a producer.
You're a producer. Okay. Wow. So they're proceeding on a parallel. Now, who are these guys? And can you tell us a little bit about Crowley and Foley? Who are they? Well, one's an Irish guy who has a Iwo Jima fetish, right? He loves it.
Yeah, he's fascinated by World War II history, particularly US Marines. And he was a stonemason who had recently had hernia surgery, so he was laid up on his couch for a couple weeks. And he's got every Ewok book that he can find, and he's reading through it. And the first thing he realizes or recognizes is the same thing that we had seen back in 2005, which is, this doesn't look like John Bradley. But then he takes it a step further and says, I think I know who it is. Wow. It's actually a rifleman named Franklin Sousley. Because there's three photos that Rosenthal took on the hill that day. The first one is the famous image. The second one is taken shortly thereafter. And on that second one, you can see that this individual who's got the cartridge belt, the wire cutters, and you know, an M7 grenade launcher on his belt is, in fact, Franklin Sousley. You can see his face. It's very clearly recognizable.
Right.
So he now has solved this mystery of who actually is in the position where we thought Bradley was. But that created another question, because Franklin Sousley had already been identified as one of the flag raisers.
Uh-oh.
So now he shares this with Eric Crowley. He says, here's what I think. I don't think this is John Bradley. I think this is actually Franklin Sousley. But if the number two man is Sousley, then who's the number three man that had been previously identified as Sousley? And so that's where Eric Crowley jumps into it. And he starts really focusing on Bill Janoust's motion picture footage from the flag raising. So it's important for people to think about this, and most don't know it unless you're a real Iwo Jima fetishist, right? Is
right.
That there were actually seven different photographers that we know of that were on the top of Suribachi in the hours leading up to, you know, and including both flag raisings. There's the first one is Staff Sergeant Lou Lowry, who is shooting for Leatherneck. And he accompanies the original 40-man patrol up the hill, shoots several dozen photos of those Marines making their way up the hill because they expected to be taken under fire at any time.
Yeah, they did not. Truth be told, that this thing is so gruesome, this fight is so crazy, and which is why it becomes one of the iconic, a third of the Medal of Honors, a third of the Navy Crosses that the Marine Corps wins in World War II are from the Battle on Iwo Jima. It is this crazy, vicious battle, and they expected to go up, and because they walk up the mountain that day, they go up, and they thought they were going to have to slug their way up, and it was if you read about the mood when these guys got going, it was pretty somber because they knew what they expected going up there.
Yeah, it's worth noting that, you know, today we talk about units like 3-5 in Afghanistan that lost, you know, 25 Marines over the course of their 7-month deployment, which is significant in terms of today's combat figures. But the easy company commander for 2nd Battalion 28th Marines had lost 3/4 of his Marines killed or wounded 5 days into the fight. So, I mean, it was, and 1/4 of all of the Marine Corps casualties for the entirety of World War II happened in 30 days on Iwo Jima.
It's crazy.
So by comparison, when the easy company commander gets the order to send a patrol up, a platoon-sized patrol up the hill, the only platoon that he has that is at any reasonable strength is the 3rd platoon at 26 Marines. And that's, they just lost their platoon commander, wounded for a second time and evacuated. So the platoon sergeant, a guy named Boots Thomas, is leading that platoon. And so he does two things, essentially. He adds 10 men from his weapon section, machine gunners and mortarmen. And then he puts his executive officer in charge of the patrol. So these then approximately 40 Marines head up the hill to make contact with the enemy. And that was actually what they were, this was a recon by fire. The battalion commander expected the Marines to take fire and thought that by sending a larger patrol up, he would draw them out. But shockingly, they made it all the way up to the top without taking a single casualty.
Yeah, that's it, which stunned everybody. All right, so you said there was many as 7 photographers that have been identified that took pictures up there.
6 identified, 1 unknown Coast Guardsman, who's probably the last photographer to get up there and photograph the flag. So Lou Lowry accompanies the patrol up. He's followed shortly thereafter by a Marine sergeant named Lou Burmeister and an Army PFC named George Burns, who's taking photos for Yank magazine, the Army equivalent of Leatherneck at the time. So those guys get up there, and they take several photos of the first flag that's gone up, that the original patrol put up. And then just after that, Joe Rosenthal, Staff Sergeant Bill Janouse, and PFC Bob Campbell all come up. Joe Rosenthal's a pool reporter for the Associated Press. Bill Janouse is a motion picture cameraman shooting 16-millimeter motion picture footage. And Bill Campbell is another still photographer, you know, shooting for the Marine Corps. So they actually passed. Lowry had dodged a few Japanese grenades shortly after the first flag went up and had broken his camera. But his film was preserved. So he actually started back down the hill and encountered Rosenthal, Janouse, and Campbell coming back up. So they weren't really on the hill at the same time. So Rosenthal and Janouse and Campbell all arrive in time to actually pose for photos. There's a photo of Staff Sergeant Janouse, Joe Rosenthal, and PSC Burns, the Army photographer from Yank magazine, standing beneath the first flag together. So all told, there's well over 70 photos taken on Suribachi over the course of about 4 or 5 hours on the morning of February 23rd. Then the 7th photographer is an unknown Coast Guard photographer who took a few photos of the second flag flying up on top of the mountain. So if you can collect all that evidence and put it, it's actually a great deal of reference information to be able to work off of.
My guest, Mike Morgan, Lieutenant Colonel, Infantry Officer, Public Affairs Officer, a principal in the research, and now a producer of a Smithsonian special that'll come to market this Sunday night at 9 p.m. on July 3rd. And you'll check it out on the Smithsonian channel entitled The Unknown Flag Raiser. We're talking about how this happened. So, you know, I made a mistake when you and I were talking the other day. I said I'd never seen the photograph of Bradley on top of the hill with his Unit 1s. And what I, to me, one of the most interesting parts of this, and Mike and I are both infantrymen. Mike, if I asked you to put together your war belt that you wore as a lieutenant in the same way that you, and gave you the stuff in the same way that you used to wear it, do you think you could do it now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm from a, you know, the H harness days.
Right.
Right. When I was a lieutenant. So I know exactly how my butt connected to my H harness and where it was and where I liked my canteens and, you know, where my K bar went on that belt and, you know, so I know that
exactly.
Well,
right.
As a matter of fact, I may or may not actually have that, you know, that 782 heater in a Foot Locker or something.
And my point is this, when, if you look at the world, the Omaha World Herald article that was published, they do a great job with the digitizing the images in these very dense, images so that you can, you know, you put your mouse over it and all this stuff is exploded and the way they label it. I told Matt, I'd never seen the picture of John Bradley with his Unit 1s on, and I have 1,000 probably or so pictures of Iwo Jima, and that's not true. I'm staring at it right now. But it was never labeled. You don't know it's him. And when you look at him and his equipment, he's a corpsman. There's no way of getting around it. His boots and his leggings are very unique, and then his helmet is also very unique. And so it got me to thinking about, how did Bradley look at that image and not say, hey, that's not me? Which kind of leads us to the next phase of this. So before we went to the break, Mike, Matt, I keep calling you Mike. Before we went to the break, Matt, you were telling us about the looking at the logbooks and how these guys were identified. And I just want you to walk the dog on that and kind of the world these guys kind of got thrust into as this Bond tour got ready to kick off. So how did they ultimately, you know, finally get identified, at least for the Bond tour?
Well, you know, for starters, the Marine Corps did not send a directive to identify those flag raisers until March 20th. So it's now a month after the flag had been raised that the Marine Corps says, we want to know who is in this Rosenthal photo. And it's a month of sustained combat for those Marines on Iwo. So when the directive arrives to the 5th Marine Division public affairs officer to get these guys identified, he turns and hands that directive to a tech sergeant named Kies Beach. And he says, Beach, you cover 28th Marines early in the fight. You go down there and see if you can figure this out. So he goes down and he finds Easy Company, and he locates the runner for Easy Company, who's Randy Gagnon. He said, Gagnon, you took this flag up there, right? And he said, yeah. He's like, do you remember who else was in the unit? And so he shows him a newspaper clipping. This is a newspaper photo that's been clipped out of a paper back in the U.S. and mailed back to Iwo Jima and arrives there so that this correspondent can make this identification. And, you know, the means that they had used to transmit the Rosenthal photo was basically like an early high-frequency version of a facsimile machine. So it wasn't the best copy of the photo available that appeared. And so we believe what Rennie Gagnon was shown was little more than a silhouette. And so he only identifies 5 men, so 3 of whom are already dead. One of those has been evacuated, which is John Bradley for leg wounds from shrapnel, and himself. So only Rennie Gagnon is ordered back to the United States, and he arrives back in Washington on April 9th. So the photo is taken on February 23rd. Gagnon arrives back in Washington on April 9th, and he's shown a full print copy of the actual Rosenthal photo. And he's asked to identify the men. Well, when he does that, he begins, and by now identifying himself in a different location, whereas originally he had placed himself in the front and John Bradley in the back, he switches those Marines and identifies Franklin Sousley as the man immediately to his right, John Bradley as the man with the rifle, and Mike Strank as the man at the far back. And there's a lieutenant named Hagenau, Colonel Hagenau. He's the executive officer for Marine Corps Public Affairs at the time. And he points to the sixth man and says, "Who's this person then?" And Gagnon pushes back. He says, "I don't really know." And Colonel pushes in. And Gagnon says, "Well, he didn't want to be identified." And the colonel tells him, "The President of the United States has directed us to identify these Marines. You're going to tell me who it is." And so Gagnon finally, under the pressure of a direct order, says, "Okay, the guy in the back with just his hand showing is Ira Hayes." And at that point, the colonel says, "Well, you say this guy here with a rifle is John Bradley, but Bradley's a corpsman. Why is he carrying a rifle?" And so Gagnon says, "Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's Bradley here in the second position and Sousley in the third." So at this point, John Bradley has now been in three different positions in the photo. Ira Hayes is in the back, and then he's moved to another position where you can clearly see it's him. And the only people that we don't know of are the other two guys in the front in the third position, which the colonel presses and says, "Okay, you said this is Hank Hansen, and then the other man is now Franklin Sousley." And Hayes, or Gagnon, agrees. And at this point, Hayes is now ordered back to the United States. So the 5th Division had already made it all the way back to Hawaii when Hayes gets his orders to come to the U.S. And he arrives on the 19th of April. And when he gets there, he immediately notices that he himself has been put in the wrong position. And the man in the front identified as Hank Hansen is actually Ira Hayes' own fireteam leader, Corporal Harlan Block. So according to Hayes' statement a year later, the colonel told him to keep quiet. In his words, both Hank Hansen and Harlan Block were dead. It didn't matter. And the most likely reason why they didn't want to change that identification is because the Marine Corps had officially announced who the flag raisers were on April 8th. So the cat was out of the bag, so to speak. So if they were to change who was in that photo, it would require them to publish a correction. So the flag raisers remained named as Hank Hansen, John Bradley, Rennie Gagnon, Franklin Sousley, Mike Strank, and Ira Hayes. And that's how it went out and remains thus for the next year, year and a half. And it wasn't until it was in December of 1946 or late 1946, that Ira Hayes felt compelled, you know, now out of service, felt compelled Harlan Block's mother a letter to tell her that it was, in fact, Harlan Block in that photo, not Hank Hansen. And that he says in his letter to Block's mother, "I tried to tell them that they had it fouled up, but I was told to keep my mouth shut." So with that, the mother sends the letter to her congressman in Texas, who then sends a letter to the commandant of the Marine Corps, A.A. Vandegrift at the time, and asks him to look into it. And so Vandegrift orders a two-star general to convene a panel to look at the identification of Hank Hansen. And that panel takes affidavits from the surviving flag raisers and comes to the conclusion that that is, in fact, Harlan Block and not Hank Hansen. So in early 1947, they issue an official correction, and the General Vandegrift writes a letter to the Hansen family informing them that Hank was actually not, in fact, in the photo.
I have an email for you. And the story to me is riveting. Matt Morgan, our guest, Lieutenant Colonel type, public affairs and infantry Marine, and gracious enough to spend some time with us this morning, and on really unraveling. I don't want to say a mystery because it wasn't a mystery for us. He and I were talking the other day. For Marines, this is like messing around in the Vatican, okay? All right, this image and this, everything that surrounds it, this is sacred. It's how we identify ourselves, all right? And, I have it on my phone. It's not a screensaver, but whatever the hell comes up when your phone goes out. You know, it's a huge part of what we see, in terms of valor. We can all quote it. We know it. And it's a gigantic icon for our culture. And the story's riveting. Email says this. Mac, when Bradley came back, did he make a statement? Are there any references to what Bradley had to say? Because by all accounts, he was an honorable man. He's a Navy Cross winner. And certainly it seems like an ordinary, great young American thrust into these extraordinary circumstances. Is there any documentation that the lieutenant colonel saw in terms of Bradley's statements? And then he goes on, awesome interview. I'm loving hearing this kind of detail. It sounds like a tremendously interesting endeavor to go back and look at logbooks and other statements associated to this. I'm jealous. Thanks for doing this. So, Matt, Bradley's story, did he file a statement, or what is there on what he said?
Well, interestingly, the only thing we have is Lieutenant Colonel Haganah's written statement. It's a very lengthy statement that was written for the investigation in 1946. And he is essentially rebutting Ira Hayes's claim that Hayes identified himself properly and that Hayes raised the misidentification of Hank Hansen as Harlan Block. He specifically says, I have no recollection of that. And I do not recall hearing the name Harlan Block ever mentioned. So what I think is particularly noteworthy is when you go back, so John Bradley is wounded about 10 days after the first flag raising. And he is evacuated and ends up back at a naval hospital, first in Honolulu, then in Oakland, California. And at some point after the photo is published and Marines are identified on April 8th, a nurse brings John Bradley a copy of the photo and says, hey, they say you're in this picture. And James Bradley, by his own account in his book, says that John Bradley could not pick himself out in the photo. So he never said he was in the picture. He never raised his hand and said, that's me. He was told he was in the photo. So the Navy then asks that he be added to any plans that the Marine Corps is making for the bond tour. And so the Navy makes arrangements through the Bureau of Medicine for John Bradley to come back to Washington. And what's notable is that Lieutenant Colonel Haganah met John Bradley at the airport. Picked him up himself, and says in his statement, I presented the image to Bradley to verify that he was indeed in the position where we had placed him, because he'd been moved a few times.
Right.
And so at that point, Bradley is in the photo. We don't know anything else. One can only surmise, and as you pointed out, I mean, everyone that I've talked to who personally knew John Bradley said he was a man of character and tremendous integrity. So I can only imagine what may have happened. And because James Bradley didn't work with us in the conduct of this, in the production of this documentary, I am actually the guy in the documentary who's put in the position of having to speculate about what John Bradley might have been thinking. And I can only imagine that, first and foremost, he probably believed he was in the photo initially. He was told he was in the photo. Remember, he was present at the first flag raising. We have photos of him standing next to the pole with his hand on that pole. And at that point, these guys had been in 4.5 days of sustained combat, some of the most brutal combat in the history of the United States Marine Corps. He says in his own letter home that he had not slept or eaten for 3 days. So any combat veteran can understand that sleep deprived, hungry, under tremendous amount of stress, having treated literally hundreds of Marines for combat casualties in the intervening days, that John Bradley might not be in a position to perfectly recall the events that had taken place on day five of the battle. So he's told he's in the photo. He believes he's in the photo. He arrives in Washington, and perhaps at some point he begins to question his placement. But one of two things probably happened at that point. He either raised the question and was told the same thing that Ira Hayes is told, which is, keep your mouth shut. It doesn't matter. You're here now. Or he knew that Hayes had received that kind of response from Haganah, and he just chose on his own to keep his mouth shut. And I think that that information really informs your reading of Flags of Our Fathers. If you consider the notion that John Bradley knew or otherwise suspected that he was not in the Rosenthal photo, it really makes you think about how he's approaching the Bond tour, the way he behaves. He says, I mean, John Bradley routinely turns the attention away from himself and back onto the Marines on Iwo.
And even it colors his conduct, constantly saying, he's fishing, and he never essentially speaks about it other than attending the when they dedicated the memorial. And when did they actually dedicate? What year? Because it shows Bradley with his wife. He's wearing horn-rimmed glasses, Ira Hayes in his overcoat. And I'm not sure what year that was.
1954.
Wow.
And, if you look at the three guys, they all look uncomfortable.
Right.
Rainey Gagnon at this point has a son. You know, the young Rainey Gagnon is there with Pauline and Rainey. John Bradley looks immensely uncomfortable.
Right.
Through the entire thing. And Ira Hayes looks miserable. Ira, that was on November 10th, 1954, and Ira Hayes had about 3 months to live at that point.
Amazing. Amazing piece of, Marine Corps history. We continue our discussion this morning, and a very gracious Matt Morgan here with us, giving up some time. Matt, can we take one more break, and then we'll talk about some of the other details, and then we'll talk about the making of the production itself?
Yeah, we'll do.
All right. We continue on. Again, as a Marine, this is – this stuff doesn't happen. So riveting history. And then also it's, all Marine Radio, and Matt and I talked about this, but dedicated to post-combat related mental health. And there is mental health issues that you see here, especially with John Bradley. And so we appreciate Lieutenant Colonel Morgan coming on this morning. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I had PTSD. Once I was back from Iraq, I was distant from everybody in my family. We had a reunion of our unit, and you'd hear these spouses say, "Is your husband doing that? My husband's doing that too. I thought it was just us." And really understanding that, hey, this is a common experience.
I learned more to listen to what he was saying, and that made it easier for me to understand where his pain was coming from.
Resources are available for military families. Learn more at realwarriors.net.
Life in the military is one of service and sacrifice. For some, that sacrifice includes physical and mental injuries or trauma that will affect their lives forever. Please join with the American Legion in recognizing and supporting our wounded warriors and their families. We need to show them that we truly are a grateful nation. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves.
For a leader, there is nothing more important than dealing with one of your soldiers who you are concerned about their emotional dealings with what we have asked them to do. You got to make sure the soldiers know that you're open at any time, any day, and you got to make sure your junior leaders are leading the same way you are. Are they encouraging soldiers instead of discouraging them from going to seek help if they need help?
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
We were rolling down this road in
Anbar Province.
Three personnel carriers.
With 16 of us on board.
All of a sudden, there's
a huge explosion.
We knew right away.
It was an IED. The first vehicle
got wasted. And those guys took
a huge hit.
Then we started taking
sniper fire and RPGs from the hills.
In today's military, women face the same dangers as men.
It's pretty amazing.
We made it out alive.
But when they come home, women veterans confront a whole different set of challenges, like unique health care issues, or not receiving respect or even acknowledgement for serving in harm's way. DAV understands the problems women veterans face, and we can help. Many DAV advisors are female veterans. They've been there, and they're ready to provide expert guidance. DAV fights to get you the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help.
I had PTSD. Once I was back from Iraq, I was distant from everybody in my family.
We had a reunion of our unit, and you'd hear these spouses say, "Is your husband doing that? My husband's doing that too. I thought it was just us." And really understanding that, hey, this is a common experience.
I learned more to listen to what he was saying, and that made it easier for me to understand where his pain was coming from.
Warriors should know that resources are available. Learn more at realwarriors.net.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. It's 8:37 here on a Monday morning. Mike McNamara with you. Matt Morgan, our guest. Matt got just an email. Mac, one of the things I'm enjoying most about All Marine Radio is that you do long format interviews, which allows us to hear details that you normally don't hear on a 15 or 20 minute interview on a radio program. Thank you very much for doing this. Tell the Colonel, God bless him for setting this straight. And I wonder if a final thought about John Bradley and the burden that he carried. So, first of all, you know, I love that about this radio program as well, sir, in that, because it's a Marine radio station, we can devote as much time as that we want, and this is certainly worthy of it. But, a final thought about John Bradley, Navy Cross winner, you know, and some people look and say somehow, in some way, shape, or form, he's tarnished in all this or whatnot. I don't. I see a guy who, as we spoke before the break, with tremendously probably mixed feelings. I don't know if I'm not in that picture. I know that my uniform doesn't look like it's in there because, as you and I talked about, I know how I wore my uniform every day. I know what I did. I did not take that stuff off at all except when I slept. And I don't think that I'm in that thing, but you know what? I got told to shut up and color. I certainly don't want the attention that would come with dredging all of this back up. I'm just going to let it go away. But certainly a restless, uneasy conscience for the rest of his life.
Yeah, absolutely. And first, let me say that I really appreciate this opportunity to come in here and talk to Marines about this in a way that, I mean, we weren't even able to fully cover in a 42-minute documentary because there's so much in this that it just takes a lot of explanation if you're not familiar with it. And this gives us a great opportunity to dig deep into a lot of these details that we can't get into or I haven't been able to get into in any of the newspaper stories or anything. So I appreciate that. But now, when it comes to John Bradley, I had to take a step and think about, you know, the context. First, let's remember that John Bradley received the Navy Cross for actions that he took a day and a half before that flag was raised. And what he did to save Marines' lives on Iwo is far more important and significant in the long run as warriors than whether or not he appeared in a photograph touching a flagpole. Now, as far as his situation and what he faced, you know, I had the opportunity to sit down with General Neller as part of the documentary. And one of the things I asked him is, you know, if you are a commander, say, at the division level, and you are ordered to send Marines back, say, the way that Chesney Puller was ordered to send John Bazelon back after Guadalcanal, what do you tell that Marine? Because those individuals are likely not very enthusiastic about leaving their buddies and going back to the States to be, you know, put out on a dog and pony show. You know, and the commandant says very simple. It's like, this is your job. You follow orders. We've been told we're sending you back, and we're going to send you back, and you're going to do it because this is your responsibility. What they were doing in terms of the Seventh War Loan was critical to the United States Treasury and its ability to fund the war effort as they planned to invade mainland Japan. So, if anything, what John Bradley was doing was his patriotic duty. And if he was told, shut up, you're going to do this, then I'm sure he did it, because he had followed much more difficult orders, you know, in the preceding months. None of those guys wanted to land on Iwo, but they knew that was their job. And they did it, and they faced appalling odds and hellish casualties in the course of doing so. So the idea of coming back and going out on a tour was probably not that significant. I mean, I don't think any of them really wanted to do it. And if you look at photos of them on the tour, they don't look happy being there. A lot of people have said that Rainey Gagnon seemed to enjoy it. After talking with his son for quite a while as part of the production of the documentary, I don't necessarily think that Rennie was so enthusiastic about it as James Bradley portrayed him to be in the book. I think they were all pretty uncomfortable. If you can imagine being snatched off of the battlefield and dropped into the Waldorf Astoria in New York, it's no wonder these guys had difficulty transitioning.
A quick comment. You know, it's one thing when we're contained, and sir, I know you've done it, but, you know, you go to memorial service after, you know, Marines have been killed in Iraq or Afghanistan. We normally wait about 10 days, and normally in those 10 days, you can find who did it. And you go kill them, and you go kill anybody who had anything to do with it. And then when you go to the memorial service, although you can't bring your friend, a comrade, a fellow Marine back, you can sit there with some satisfaction knowing that anybody who had anything to do with it is dead. And that's us as Marines, as warriors, as part of our culture. When you step out of that and you see the mothers, that is brutal, because that's not part of what we do very well. It's just this raw, it has to do with a son, not a fellow Marine. And, you know, one of the parts of his book that to me was so brutal was when they meet in Philadelphia with, I believe it's Mike Strank's mother, with, Salzy's mom, and all these families are there, and they come face to face, and they all lose it. I've got an email that says this: Mac, great show today. I'm enjoying all the details, as I'm sure any Marine or Corpsman would. Speaking of Corpsmen, they're sacred to we infantrymen. If anybody has any shit to talk about John Bradley, please send me their address, and I will go to their home and beat their ass. Signed, an infantry Marine. But that is the culture. Yes, sir?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think, again, none of this nothing in this documentary seeks to take anything away from Doc Bradley. It's very clear that he loved those Marines. If you know the story, to me, it's, you know, John Bradley is back in the States on this tour, and his best friend in Easy Company had been dragged into a hole in the middle of the night and tortured by the Japanese. And they don't find him until several days after he's gone missing. And I'm sure that Doc Bradley is carrying that with him the entire time he's on this tour. And as you mentioned, Mike Strank, Sergeant Strank, was absolutely loved by every man in 3rd Platoon. They thought he was a living god. I got a chance to talk to a rifleman who was one of the youngest guys in Easy Company, a guy named Pete Griffin. And Pee-wee would talk about Mike Strank and still get tears in his eyes. He was standing next to Strank when he was killed. And what the Marines would have done for him, and to see them gone, you know, talk about Ira Hayes and he was going through and his alcoholism. He was in Harlan Block's fire team. He and Franklin Stousley were both riflemen in Harlan Block's fire team, and Mike Strank was their squad leader. And so Ira was one of the only surviving men from that squad. Indeed, one of the few men who walked off that island without a scratch on him. And so what he must have been dealing with, what he experienced when he saw Strank's mother, I can only imagine.
You know, a friend of mine, Brigadier General Dave Furness, who's now at the Office of Legislative Affairs, I want to say last year, I don't know if it was Memorial Day, but he called me and I said, hey, on a Saturday, we're battle buddies times three, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I said, hey, what are you doing? He said, I'm driving up to Pennsylvania. I said, what's going on up there? He said, I'm going to give a speech in Mike Strank's hometown. They do a day for him every year. And I get to go give a speech. And I was just, again, this is like walking through Valhalla for Marines. The name Mike Strank. You say Mike Strank and, you know, Marines, you don't have to say anything else. But that's how, with the kind of reverence that Marines still look at these guys who fought. Text message. Mac, what can Matt tell us about Harold Schultz? He seems, from everything I've read, to have come home, went back to work, and put this stuff on the shelf and gone about his life and never required any fame or never cared to straighten the record out. What does he know about him? So Harold Schultz, PFC type, right?
Yeah, PFC. First, I have developed this tremendous affection for Schultz through the course of this process. One of the things that's will strike you, and Marines in particular, is that we were very lucky that Harold seems to be kind of an odd duck. He is one of those Marines, everybody has one in the platoon, where he's always got something just a little bit screwed up. You know, his belt's twisted in the back, or he can't quite get his helmet on, you know, his chin strap's lopsided. That's Schultz. We were able to identify him because he had a broken liner chin strap that was hanging down in front of his left eye. For anybody else, that would have driven you so crazy, you'd have ripped the thing right off. But it didn't seem to bother Harold at all. You know, and then the other thing was that, Harold's M1 rifle was improperly slung. He, rather than having the sling attached at the upper swivel, it was attached all the way out at the stacking swivel. So that his rifle hung extremely awkwardly. And you can see it now that you know, once your attention's been called to it and you look at the Rosenthal photo, it slaps you right in the face. And his M1 rifle is hanging so low as to be incredibly awkward. And what we figured out once we started parsing through all of the images was that the set screw that holds his upper swivel D-ring to the band had come out. It was missing. And so he had simply lengthened his sling and run the eyelet on the D-ring through the end of his stacking swivel. So it was probably like a field expedient, you know, fix. Right, but right. At the moment and the time, you can imagine his platoon sergeant, you know, or the machine gun or the mortar sergeant looking at him and just shaking his head.
Schultz.
You know, Schultz. Just Schultz again.
Again.
Again. You're sure that this isn't the first time this type of thing has happened. I mean, Harold's wearing his bandolier underneath his field jacket. He's got his K-bar in the center back of his cartridge belt. It just all looks really awkward, but it also makes him very notable, which is ultimately what led us to be able to identify him. As far as what we know about him, there could not be a more obscure human being that would be more difficult to locate in today's day and age. Harold was raised in Detroit. We know from the 1930 and 1940 census information that he lived in the same house his entire young life. He had one sister who was 8 years older than him, and in 1940, she was in her mid-20s and living at home with her parents. Her occupation was listed as shop girl. And so we had a feeling from the very beginning that there was a good possibility that Harold's sister had never married, because she already seemed to be, heading toward that old maid kind of lifestyle, even in 1940. So Harold enlists in December of 1943, 1 month before his 18th birthday. Yeah, it's important to note, age 17, you could enlist, but by age 18, you would be required to enter service. And at that point, the U.S. government would tell you which service you were going into. So men like Harold Schultz, Pee Wee Griffiths, and several of the other privates that were in E.T. Company went down and enlisted when they were 17 so that they could choose to go into the Marine Corps. And in so doing, they would have known that it was very likely they were going to the Pacific. So Harold ends up, despite the fact that he's in Detroit, he ends up being sent out to San Diego, because they're pushing all of the new recruits out to San Diego because they know that they have to form the 5th Marine Division, which would be the spearhead for the landings at Iwo. So Harold goes out there. He becomes a mortarman. He spends much of 1944 training at Camp Pendleton. And then in the fall of that year, in September, he embarks and goes on to Hawaii, where the division continues to train for the landing at Iwo Jima. So they go on. They land at Iwo. Harold is wounded on March 13th, almost 3 weeks after the flag raising, and wounded in the abdomen and has a severe wound to the hand that ultimately makes him disabled, qualifies for disability. So when he is discharged at the end of 1945, he is given priority placement with other federal services. And as you and I talked the other day, it's really important to note, when you consider what the Marine Corps experience was for Harold, he spent less than 2 years in the Marine Corps uniform.
Crazy.
Harold may well never have even owned a pair of dress blues. He in December 43 goes to a week boot camp, gets put in the 5th Marine Division, lands on Iwo, is wounded just under a month after having hit the beaches there, is evacuated to Hawaii. He's so badly wounded that he cannot return to EC Company when they get back to Hawaii, and he's discharged in Great Lakes, Illinois. And at that point, he got placement with the U.S. Postal Service, was sent on to Los Angeles, where he worked as a mail sorter. His hand was a problem for him, so he really could only use one hand. Mail sorting was something that he could reasonably do. He worked in the Chinatown area of L.A., the post office. We know that he was engaged to be married to a woman named Mary. We don't know anything about her. We just have a photo. We don't know her last name. But she died of a brain tumor before they could be married. And Harold basically remained a bachelor for the next 20 years. He lived next door to a woman named Rita Reyes. And he would have dinner with her and her daughter for several years. So it was just basically they had apartments next to each other that shared a balcony. So he had dinner with Rita and talked to her daughter, Desreen, quite a bit. But she just called him a very reserved and quiet guy. Desreen, who was raised in California, repeatedly referred to him as one of those self-effacing Midwestern types. And so you can imagine kind of from that perspective what Harold was like. And yeah. So when Harold was 63, he and Rita decided that they would marry. He never had any children of his own. And he died 1 year after John Bradley in 1995. And he never really spoke much at all about his experiences on AWOL, like many of the Marines. It wasn't until after his wife's death, after Rita's death, that his stepdaughter found a shoebox in the back of her mother's closet that included just a few of Harold's personal items, a couple of portraits that he had taken at a photo studio in Laguna Niguel. One photo was he's in his alphas with his 5th Marine Division patch, probably shortly after the 5th Marine Division patch was approved and distributed. And then a second one after he made PFC. So he's got his mosquito wings on in his photo. Other than that, he had a picture that was the copy of the picture that was the third photo that Rosenthal had taken that day, commonly referred to as the gung-ho photo, which was kind of like a team picture, so to speak, of the Marines from the first patrol, 14 of them, standing beneath the second flag. On the back of that, he had written very carefully the names of each Marine in the picture, and he had had the photo signed by Joe Rosenthal at a reunion several years later. It was very difficult for us to find anybody who could remember Harold. But of course there are very few Marines from Easy Company still surviving today. None of the mortarmen from Easy Company were alive to talk to. I talked to one machine gunner from Easy Company, and when I brought up Harold's name, he simply said, never heard of him. And then when I talked to the Easy Company commander, retired Colonel Dave Severance, he said it was hard to remember Harold. He actually had to look at an old photo that he had to even remember who he was. But there was one Marine who remembered him, and that was Pee Wee Griffith. And we talked to Pee Wee, and he really just describes Harold as a quiet guy that I kept to himself. And that explains a lot when we consider the notion that Harold decided to remain silent about this for 60 years.
Matt Morgan, our guest, he one of the producers of the upcoming Smithsonian Channel film that premieres this Sunday night at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific, entitled The Unknown Flag Raiser of Iwo Jima. Matt, first of all, can I impose on you on the air to come back again next week after we watch it and talk about it a little bit more?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Okay. And then, second of all, tell us about the production itself. It's an hour. It'll take an hour. And what are we going to see?
Well, first of all, we set it up by telling the story of Iwo, which is one of the great opportunities here, is that talking about this story gives us an opportunity to present, you know, the story of Iwo Jima to a whole new generation. Beyond that, we really get into the details of how we identified Harold and then the process that we undertook to build a case that we thought would be compelling enough to get the United States Marine Corps to consider what we had presented. Initially, when I came, we took the Omaha World Herald piece and had a really brief, informal discussion with the Marine Corps' chief historian. And he was extremely skeptical, which is understandable because for Marines out there, it might be surprising to hear that there have been several hundred cases where individual Marines or family members of deceased Marines have approached the Marine Corps and said, my father said he's in this picture. And it's a difficult position for the historians to be in because they routinely just have to say, you know, we're sorry, but we are certain that we have properly identified these individuals. And while there is no complete roster of that 40-man patrol in existence, we're pretty sure that your father would not have been there, or your uncle, your brother, et cetera. So when we approached the Marine Corps initially with the Crelly theory about Harold Schultz, they were extremely skeptical, but to their credit, remained open, provided that we were willing to take the time and share the evidence with them. And so that's really what happened and what was chronicled. So it's important to note that we didn't provide the full analysis to the Marine Corps until January of this year. And they found the information so compelling that they took it to the Commandant, and the Commandant decided to convene this panel and charged the panel with looking at all available evidence to identify not just this one individual, but to reaffirm the identity of all six men in the photo. And so that's what they did. They looked at the photo and they assigned a degree of verifiability to each of those. So they talk about that and the process that we undertook in the film. And then, of course, we had the opportunity to sit down with General Neller and talk to him about the findings, what his ultimate decision was, and what about that is important.
Matt, first of all, again, can't thank you enough for coming on and doing this in the detail that you've done it. To me, absolutely a riveting walk through history. And I can't tell you how excited I am personally to see your work and then have you back on and talk about it again, because it is Marine Corps history. And I will tell you what, it does bring up one of the greatest exercises in valor and unselfless courage that we as Marines have in our history, and that is the Battle of Iwo Jima. So thank you very much for the visit. Can't wait to see your work and look forward to talking to you next week.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. And hey, Matt, we'll turn this into a YouTube video later on tonight. We'll throw your picture up there. So if you have a good one, send it. And so people that search hopefully will hear this and get a chance to listen to the long format interview. So it'll be out there on YouTube this evening. So thanks for the help.
Great. Thank you.
You bet. That is Matt Morgan.
Bye.
Unbelievable. An unbelievable story, and it'll be a great thing to watch. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break, and we come back. First Lieutenant Carl Marlanis. He's a writer and a tremendously interesting guy, Rhodes Scholar, and has written Matterhorn and a book entitled What It's Like to Go to War. He is 35 years ahead of the rest of us in terms of his post-Vietnam experience, PTSD, what he went through, how he's dealt with it. He has thoughts on coming home. He has thoughts on national service. He has thoughts on the all-volunteer force. And he has thoughts on post-combat-related mental health. We're going to talk to him next as a great morning in All Marine Radio continues right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.